From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in San Francisco in the Glen Park area.
Sunset, Portola Valley.
I currently reside in Nob Hill.
West Portal.
I live in Russian Hill.
Coming up, we'll take a look at what UC Berkeley fraternities are doing to prevent rape on campus.
We realized it was absolutely time for a change. Greek system has issues.
Then we'll talk to an activist who blogs about what it's like to be a queer person of color in a racially charged time.
It's nice to get together with people who, you know, share some of your identity and, like, talk really seriously and radically about change.
And we'll visit the StoryCorps booth to hear from a woman whose faith was at odds with her sexuality.
I remember that religion really helped me. If anything, it made me feel more depressed. Like, God is not going to like me.
How others see us and how we see ourselves. Today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Sexual assault has become an increasingly heated topic on college campuses across the country. And when these conversations arise, so inevitably does the topic of fraternities. Here in the Bay Area, fraternities based at UC Berkeley have also had their share of problems. According to the University of California Police Department, the majority of reported sexual assaults on campus since October of last year occurred at frat houses. At one of them, five people reported being drugged and assaulted all in the same weekend.
Delta Kappa Epsilon Fraternity, which is not recognized by the university but sits in the middle of UC Berkeley's Greek Row, is where five people were allegedly drugged and assaulted.
UC Berkeley has been under federal investigation in the past year, and it's been working to address sexual assault issues with new mandatory workshops for students. KALW's Liz Mack tells us that some of the school's fraternities say they're doing the same.
I'm standing just across from the UC Berkeley campus on Piedmont Avenue. This is Berkeley's fraternity row. It's a Saturday night, and young women like Trixie Scolari and Tara Harmon wander past. The two are deciding whether or not to go to a fraternity party that evening.
Do you guys feel safe when you go to parties?
I do. Again, that's your attitude. I go in and we're really careful.
Like, in general, I think we're both, like, pretty smart, and we're, you know, if we are drinking, we're watching our drinks and not drinking too much.
Scolari says she's met a lot of nice people at frat parties. She says she's not concerned about the individuals. Her worries are about the institution.
They do occasionally foster environments that I think are unsafe for women especially.
Of the half dozen or so women I talked to that night, few wanted to talk on the record. But I wanted to uncover more behind what Scolari told me about her impressions that frats and the parties they host are unsafe for women.
As you would expect, there's pretty much only one goal, which is for the guys to hook up with the girls.
That's sophomore Tatiana Gosby.
That's why there are, like, no couches really to sit on, or, like, there's, like, loud music. I mean, like, the environment's, like, not meant for, like, conversations. It's, like, meant for, like, hooking up.
People don't know them for, like, doing their national philanthropy or something, but
that's Gosby's friend, Anna Mai. She says frat parties do have a bit of a bad rep on campus, but Gosby says women have to take responsibility when they go to one.
If you put yourself in that position, like, I'm not saying it's, like, right, but, like, you have to be smart about
it. Before now, rape prevention centered around Take Back the Night events, where women united against fear and violence. But it was clearly on the women to protect themselves and prevent rapes. Now, a new way of talking about sexual violence is emerging. Women shouldn't have to take back the night. And it isn't just women who are being assaulted. The new logic goes like this. Perpetrators should be taught not to perpetrate. I asked Gosby if that new way of thinking, that it's not on women to prevent rape, was evident on campus.
Yeah, I don't think it... Well, it's not realistic at, like, a frat party so much, I would say.
Some other women on campus say the same thing, that you have to be careful at these parties. Here's student Sonia Hudson.
You know, they host parties. They put a lot of effort into decorating it. They, you know, buy lots of alcohol. And so they kind of expect something in return for that. And so I think that combined with not understanding what consent is leads to sexual assault a lot of times.
People think of the fraternity as like this monolithic entity, you know.
That's James Stewart, a junior at Cal, and the president of the Inter Fraternity Council, or IFC, at UC Berkeley. That means he is in charge of leading 32 frats on campus. That's not all of them, but it covers the majority, about 1,300 young men. He says fraternities are very aware of the reputation that precedes them. That's why, at the end of last year, Stewart wrote an op-ed to the campus paper, the Daily Californian, announcing major changes to the IFC.
We realized it was absolutely time for a change.
Those changes included mandatory education on consent and active bystander training for all IFC fraternities each semester. Also, the IFC created a new executive position on its council to encourage more dialogue on the subject. So, do all these new programs mean frats have something to prove?
Absolutely. And I think that anybody you talk to who's done any work on the subject would acknowledge that forthright. We realize that Greek system has issues.
But what exactly are those issues?
I think it's impossible to drill down on like exactly what the issue is. Some people are saying it's the Greek system, and some people are saying it's a national issue. I don't think it's really my place to judge like where this issue comes from. I think it's really just handling the practical consequences of this issue in our community.
It is a national issue, one that's impossible to ignore. But whether rape or sexual assault on campus is the product of Greek culture or just culture in general, Stewart isn't completely clear. Still, he says he's trying to change more than policy on campus. He's trying to change the conversation. And he says frats are the best place to start that shift.
If we are successful in starting a conversation about consent, about, these issues, then that's something that's talked about at lunch, when you're studying, while you're at class, while you're walking to class, while you're living together.
You can teach people about how not to litter. Does that mean that they're not going to litter? I don't know.
That's Ariana Nase. She's the president of the Pan-Hellenic Council of Sororities on campus, which also implemented mandatory trainings for sorority sisters. She says even these new trainings aren't enough, and they don't change the old paradigm that women are asked far more than men to prevent rape.
We teach our women to like watch they drink to remain in control. That's pretty sad. You have to constantly be watching yourself because somebody could do something to you at any given point.
And that's not ideal. But Nase says for now, it's practical.
Unfortunately, we can't really figure out a better solution. You are the biggest like proponent of yourself.
But being your own biggest proponent isn't always enough to protect you. Megan Warner was assaulted her freshman year at a fraternity party. Now she's a junior and the co-chair of Greeks Against Sexual Assault. She's helped organize trainings and curriculum for workshops in both the IFC and the Pan-Hellenic Council. And she thinks the system needs to take the issue more seriously.
One chapter on this campus gives their fraternity men like little mini like shout-outs/awards at every meeting if they've like hooked up with someone. I heard it from a member of that fraternity.
When I asked James Stewart about this, he said he doesn't think this story's true, though he's no way of verifying. He told me if it were true, that fraternity would be severely punished.
I think they don't fully understand the implications of their actions.
For Warner, she says many fraternity members recognize that sexual assault is a larger societal problem, but they don't see how they contribute to it. Warner, understandably, no longer goes to frat parties. But when asked, she says she doesn't know if she blames her own assault on frat culture.
Do you think it would have happened if that party wasn't a frat party?
I can't know. I have no way of knowing. I can't predict what could have happened. Lots of things could have happened differently. But what I can say is that other members of the fraternity like saw what was going on and didn't intervene and didn't do anything.
And that is why there's this new emphasis on educating, to say something, to intervene, to learn about consent. As of now, 15 of the 32 IFC chapters have finished their trainings. After all of them are completed, the next question for the fraternities will be, did any of this make a difference? For Cross Currents, I'm Liz Mack.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. There's another important conversation going on in the East Bay, a conversation about racism. Earlier this month, a police officer in South Carolina was arrested for murder after a video of him shooting an unarmed black man at a traffic stop was released. This arrest follows a year of high-profile police shootings of black men, shootings that led to protests and discussions about race in Oakland, like Black Brunch and the Black Lives Matter campaign. But in many ways, we're just joining a conversation that's been going on for a while. Oakland's Mia McKenzie has been writing about black, brown, and queer identity on her blog, Black Girl Dangerous, since 2011. She says the popular blog started out of anguish, but has gone on to give voice to queer and trans people of color. McKenzie stopped by our studios to talk with KALW's Todd Whitney about her work.
First things first, just tell me about yourself. How'd you begin writing Black Girl Dangerous?
Well, I started writing Black Girl Dangerous kind of accidentally. I was dealing with some personal issues and had this really bad relationship thing happen where I was sort of confronted with this idea ultimately of blackness as hostility, blackness as aggression, and kind of this, all the stereotypes around the angry black woman. I sort of was at a crossroads feeling like, okay, is this just going to, am I going to have to continually make myself smaller, basically, in order to not, you know, feel threatening to white people, basically, and particularly white women. And it's super traumatizing, so I don't talk about it too much. But basically, I kind of decided that instead of being smaller because of that stereotype, I was going to just be bigger. And I was really going to own, you know, my dangerousness, this idea that I could stand up for myself and I could take up space and I could have boundaries and I could assert myself. And I was not going to let the angry black woman stereotype kind of stop me from doing that. And so I just kind of went on Tumblr and I was writing about things that I thought were important, about race and gender and queerness and stuff. And my friends started reading it and sharing it with their friends, and their friends started reading it and sharing it with their friends, and it just kind of really blew up into this thing that I never expected.
You know, last year, 2014, was like a big year for a lot of these conversations about race in America. And just in general, what are your thoughts about a lot of these conversations that are taking off right now?
Well, I mean, I have a lot of thoughts about them.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of conversations about race and racism, and there isn't enough action about race and racism. I think we think of race and racism as this thing that's a lot based on feelings and how do we feel about each other and what do we think about each other. And that's some of it. But what we really need to be doing is taking action against the systems of oppression, right? We sort of talk about it like, you know, these big things happen, you know, with the Mike Brown, you know, thing that sort of launched this Black Lives Matter movement in this big way. You know, that incident is such a, it's a huge thing, but it's such a small thing when you think about just the levels of systemic oppression that happen every day. And when we talk about it, the ways that we talk about it, we don't always get to the crux of it and the stuff that's underneath it that allows those things to happen over and over again with impunity. And that's what we need to be doing, and that's what we need to be taking action against.
So what do you think, like, blogs like your own, like Black Girl Dangerous or any sort of blog, can sort of push us beyond that point of conversation? You know, how can blogging escape the realm of just talking about stuff and actually getting to actually mobilizing, getting something done?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's one of the challenges for not only blogging, but for, you know, any kind of media, right? Because that's what you're doing. You're having the conversation. You're having the discussion. It's not that we shouldn't be having conversations, but we need to be aware of what we're having conversations about. Are we having conversations about the laws, you know, that oppress people? Are we having conversations about the institutions that oppress people? Or is it always just these sort of interpersonal relationship things? And I also, too, think that, you know, there is a lot of organizing happening. Like, we're always talking about, you know, go here. If you're in this city, this is what's happening. Go and be a part of this. And I think that's really important, too.
Yeah, that's what's up, because I was actually following, like, a lot of the stuff that you were, I follow you on Twitter.
Okay.
And I was, like, checking out a lot of the stuff you had going on back in mid-November with everything popping off with Eric Garner and Mike Brown,
right,
and stuff like that.
Right.
So I'm here talking with Mia McKenzie, the founder of Black Girl Dangerous. Do you think there's any sort of risk of an echo effect, potentially creating, like, an echo chamber amongst people, like-minded people, only talking to themselves?
Well, no. I mean, A, I'm for an echo chamber. I think echo chambers are highly underrated when you're talking about radical conversation, when you're talking about oppressed people. You know, and I don't think that all marginalized people necessarily have, I mean, I know that we don't all have the same ideas, right? So even if we're talking to each other, it doesn't mean that we're all in agreement. It doesn't mean that we're all bringing the same things to the table. And like I said, depending on what your particular identity is, your experience can be vastly different from someone else's, and you can both still be queer and trans people of color, right? And so, I mean, we have such a wealth and such a diversity of experiences just within that group of queer and trans people of color. So I think, you know, so I don't think that we're sort of just like telling each other everything that we already know. In fact, we're not at all. Like, we're bringing new ideas to each other. We're giving each other new frameworks to think about how to create solidarity. And all that said, I also think that, you know, when you live in a world where you never get to have a voice, where you're always the one who isn't heard, it's nice to get together with people who, you know, share some of your identity and like talk really seriously and radically about change, you know, and about how to fight oppression. I think the idea of the echo chamber is usually this idea that, oh, but you have to have everyone's perspective. You know, you have to listen to everyone. And I don't think that you do. I don't, you know, in an ideal world where we're all, you know, already coming from the same sort of level of being heard, right? All things being equal, when everybody has, you know, everybody has the same platforms, everybody has the same, you know, access, then sure, great. Everybody have an opinion, please weigh in. But that's not reality. The reality is that some of us never get heard. Some of us never get to have a voice. And so just making space for those of us who don't to finally have that, just us, is, I think, radical and amazing. And that's, you know, important to me to be doing that.
How has social media and the internet made a lot of this possible, what you're just talking about, this experience of sharing the nuances of even just being a black person or being a person of color or a queer person? How has the internet, social media allowed this stuff to happen?
Well, it has a lot. I think, you know, one thing, you know, social media has been around for a while now, Facebook and Twitter in particular, which are the sort of the biggies. And I was really struck back in August last year when Mike Brown was killed. You know, that story broke on Twitter, you know. I mean, literally, I remember being on Twitter and there was, saw a retweet of a guy who had seen what had happened, who literally was tweeting like, oh my God, I just saw this thing that just happened. And then people retweeted that and then, you know, and other people who were there started tweeting and it was just like this huge thing that broke. And it was days before anybody, you know, in mainstream, you know, journalism even cared to, you know, say anything about it. And it became this huge thing. That movement started because people had access to Twitter, you know, and were able to like put out, you know, I mean, even like pictures like this guy and this is what just happened. And so that's been hugely important for just getting these stories out there. And since then, there's been so many of those same sorts of stories that just nobody would know about if people weren't talking about them on Twitter. As great as Twitter and, you know, Facebook and these things are for you know, all the great things that we've been able to do, the truth is that, you know, these things, they're owned by corporations. And, you know, we can't trust corporations to, you know, you know, have our backs, you know, in the struggle, frankly.
That was Mia McKenzie, activist and author of the blog Black Girl Dangerous. She spoke with KALW's Todd Whitney. Find a link to her blog at our website, KALW.org. Click on Cross Currents. Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. Elizabeth Beltran Lario struggled with her identity for much of her childhood. She was born in Oakland, but was raised in a small town south of Jalisco, Mexico. Growing up, she felt alienated from the Catholic Church because of her sexual orientation. But her exposure to Buddhism in college helped her come to terms with who she is and what she believes. She sat down in the StoryCorps booth to share her story of this transformation.
with me. Like, religion has always been a difficult topic in my life. My family is very cultural, very traditional, so of course we had to go to church every Sunday. I remember that I didn't really like it, but I mean, it was good spiritually. But when I was a teenager, there was a clash because I discovered that I was like bisexual and that didn't fit with my religion. When I was a kid, it seemed like a no-no, a taboo. You can't do that if you're Catholic. And so I felt alienated and out of the norm. I remember that religion didn't really help me. If anything, it made me feel more depressed. Like, God is not going to like me. I'm going to go to hell. I just remember that it was a difficult situation in my life, especially when I was finding my identity. So I decided to stay away from religion for a while. When I was in college, I went through, I had a class of Buddhism, and our teacher taught us about that. And I remember being a little bit reluctant because I was like, I don't want to know about religion if, you know, I'm going to feel like an outcast. But then I learned about El Octuple Sendero, which is like the 8 steps of Buddhism. And one of the greatest things they taught me is that suffering is something that cannot be avoided. And they told us that what matters is how you deal with suffering. You have to learn that things will never stay. Like, you will never be young forever. You will never be healthy forever. You will never have your family members with you forever. So that taught me carpe diem, seize the day. You know, life is not, it's not there for us. Like, we should not take it for granted. We should enjoy life, our family members, our connections, because they will be gone one day when we least expect it. And I think spiritually I felt cleansed, happy, and it didn't really matter my identity, my sexual identity. And so I think religion has helped me come to terms with who I am and to deal with pain. You know, knowing that nothing will stay forever.
That was Elizabeth Beltran Larios talking with Sam Garcia at Life Academy in Oakland. That story came to us from StoryCorps. It was facilitated by Chris Hambrick and produced by Colin Peden for KLW's project The Spiritual Edge, stories at the intersection of innovation and belief. Find more at KALW.org and click on The Spiritual Edge. And if you've got a story you want us to cover, we want to know about it. Email us at news@KALW.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW. You can also give us a call. The number is 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Leela Day, Jeremy Delmas, Jack Detch, Audrey Dilling, Rachel Dornhelm, Marcy Fraser, Stephen Short, and Seth Samuel. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Angela Johnston. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Rebecca Dumain, along with the Dave Miller Trio. You can hear them at Angelica's in Redwood City this Saturday night. Music starts at 8:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. Better than chocolate eclairs, better than hothouse tomatoes, better than fresh Bartlett pears, better than dining a la carte, or sampling gastronomic art, better than anything except being in love. Better than making a million, better than being a queen, better than oil wells and gold mines, better than pastures of green, better than finding a horseshoe.